ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Stephanie Smale, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight, Donald Trump says he'll resume testing of nuclear weapons as he meets with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Also, new questions about the safety of Australian sunscreens. And if you lived on Slag Street, would you want people to know about it? Residents in Broken Hill are fed up that their street sign keeps getting stolen.
I think it's a good name because, you know, you can see why I get a little bit irate. Mm. This is a matter of years this has been going on.
There are hopes the bitter trade war between the United States and China could be over, with Presidents Donald Trump and Xi Jinping meeting face-to-face to negotiate a deal. Before the highly anticipated meeting in South Korea, President Trump described President Xi as a tough negotiator, and President Xi said it was important to steady the ship. Donald Trump has also announced he's ordering the United States to resume nuclear weapons testing. The ABC's North Asia correspondent, James Oten, is in South Korea. James, starting with Donald Trump's meeting with the Chinese leader, we've seen months of escalating tensions between these two countries over trade. What will it take to steady the ship, as President Xi puts it?
Well, from Donald Trump's perspective, this meeting went phenomenally well. When asked about how it went, he said from a scale of 1 to 10, he gave it a 12. Some of the key issues, and perhaps the most important issue, rather, is the restrictions of rare earths. China is the dominant player in this space. They control around 90% of production. And as this trade war between China and the United States escalated over several months, China confirmed that it would put a big clamp on its exports of rare earths. And this is an industry that's vital for high-tech equipment. And basically, under these restrictions, nothing would leave China unless Beijing gave it explicit approval. So this was clearly China pushing back against Donald Trump. But after this meeting, Donald Trump has said the issue has been settled. So that's one of the big wins for Donald Trump, if he is, of course, correct in him declaring that the industry will now just open up again. He has confirmed he will drop tariffs against the United States. Some of these tariffs were just broader tariffs. Other tariffs were linked to the chemicals used in fentanyl. He said that China has agreed to helping fight fentanyl, so therefore those tariffs will go down as well. He's also announced that China would resume buying soybeans. Now, this was another tactic China used during these trade wars. I guess the final sensitive issue here that we were expecting to be discussed was microchips. Donald Trump put restrictions on China's access to advanced microchips during his first presidential term. And this is something that China's been unhappy with for quite some time now. Donald Trump did announce that he would be open to allowing China to buy some advanced NVIDIA microchips. But after this meeting, there's been no deal done. So it looks like negotiations on that front will continue. So whether or not the ship is now steady, we'll just have to wait and see. The problem here is that you've got two very powerful countries that are trying to sway the global order. And so the concern generally is, even if a deal is done today, what will it take for tensions to resume? It almost seems inevitable that there will be something that will go wrong again down the line and tensions will continue to escalate again.
There's also been the development that Donald Trump has instructed the Pentagon to start matching other nuclear powers in their testing of nuclear weapons. Has there been any reaction to that so far?
Well, this was a huge curveball that Donald Trump announced just before he was meeting with Xi Jinping. The last couple of days, all he's been talking about is how great the meeting will go with Xi Jinping and how optimistic he was. There was certainly no indication that this was on the agenda. But then on Truth Social, his social media platform, he announced that it was time for the United States to resume nuclear testing. Now, the United States hasn't done this since 1992, so that's three decades ago now. But really, even though this was announced just before the meeting with Xi Jinping, and the president was asked about why he made this announcement as he was meeting Xi Jinping, and he didn't answer that, even though the timing seems like it might be pointed at China, it's more likely that this announcement was targeted towards Russia, because Russia has been conducting a series of nuclear tests in recent weeks and months. We know that Donald Trump has also talked about his excellent rapport with Vladimir Putin, but every time he talks about ending the war and getting a ceasefire and how great his relationship with Vladimir Putin is, it seems that Russia just disappoints him again and again. So it would be more likely that this announcement that the United States is resuming nuclear testing is a pushback against Russia and a pushback against its nuclear testing that it's been carrying out in recent weeks and months. Ultimately, Donald Trump is justifying it, saying the US needs to keep testing or it'll fall behind.
ABC North Asia correspondent James Oten. Hurricane Melissa is continuing its devastating sweep across the Caribbean, destroying homes, flooding neighbourhoods and leaving dozens dead. Authorities say the death toll is rising in Haiti and at least four people have been killed in Jamaica. It's one of the strongest storms on record to hit the region, with residents now beginning the long and difficult clean-up. Alison Shaw reports.
This is the damage of Melissa.
Total
disaster.
Jamaicans wade through the streets amid the wreckage left by Hurricane Melissa. As the storm lashed the Caribbean nation, winds of up to 300 kilometres shredded trees and tore off buildings' roofs. One resident in the country's northwest, Sasha Hamilton, says the properties in her neighbourhood were inundated.
I had to go down, the water was submerged to here. We had to go down and rescue like older people, children. It was so catastrophic and frightening.
In Jamaica, four bodies have been recovered after one of the strongest Atlantic hurricanes on record. But dozens have died in Haiti. Authorities there reporting at least 40 people have died. Most were killed when a river burst its banks in Petit Guave. Stephen Guadard says he lost four of his children.
A one-month-old baby, a seven-year-old, an eight-year-old, and another who was about to turn four. All four are gone.
Some Haitians say the response from the government has been disappointing.
To be honest, the storm gave us time to prepare, but it seems like the government and NGOs didn't use that time to help us.
We would like that they gave us security to help us back home, but it looks like we are not human anymore. We are not alive.
Hurricane Melissa also swept through Cuba, where more than 700,000 people remain in temporary shelters. No deaths have been reported there so far. Luis de Jesus is a journalist with BT Newsroom and is in Santiago de Cuba.
Actually, it was not as strong as expected. The Cuban population and the authorities were expecting for maybe a Category 4, Category 5 hurricane. But thankfully, it lowered its intensity just before making landfall here in Santiago de Cuba.
Cuba appears to have avoided the worst of the damage, but the nation's already weak economy will make the recovery difficult.
Cuba has been going through several blackouts in the last 2 years. Also, the economic crisis that Cuba is going through, that might be the most, let's say, the thing that could worry the most the population right now, and if they are going to be able to build up with the speed they need.
In Jamaica, locals there are worried about the recovery effort too.
When we say flat, all who have decos flat, all who have zinc flat, we need help now!
Thousands have been left homeless and most of the island is still without power. Authorities say the damage is even more widespread than previously thought.
Some describe it as a scene out of an apocalyptic movie.
Kimon Francis is a journalist with Kingston's Jamaica Gleaner newspaper.
Already we're hearing of reports of bodies being found, but of course the number is unconfirmed because it keeps climbing.
The main region impacted by Hurricane Melissa produces much of the nation's food.
Now we'll be importing way more than we export. We already import two times what we export, and so you can just imagine how difficult it will be going forward.
In Florida, volunteers with the charity Food for the Poor are loading pallets of aid destined for Jamaica. Ed Rain is the organisation's CEO.
We're looking at about 1.6 million people of the 3 million, so more than half are going to be impacted in some way. So there's going to be a lot of need, and Food for the Poor intends to be able to deliver and help as much as we can.
There are still storm warnings for people in the Turks and Caicos Islands, the Bahamas and Bermuda.
Alison Shaw reporting. Australia's cricket community is mourning the death of 17-year-old junior player Ben Austin, who was hit in the neck by a ball at practice. The tragedy has reignited the debate about protective gear in sport and revived memories of the death of Australian cricketer Philip Hughes in similar circumstances in 2014. Today, the Hughes family has issued a statement paying tribute to the teenager and offering condolences to his family. Kathleen O'Connor reports.
Flowers, lollies and notes were laid at the Ferntree Gully cricket nets as news spread of the death of 17-year-old junior cricketer Ben Austin. The teenager was rushed to hospital after being hit in the neck with a ball during a training session. He died a short time later. His parents releasing this statement. This tragedy has taken Ben from us, but we find some comfort that he was doing something he did for so many summers, going down to the nets with mates to play cricket. He loved cricket.
As a club, we're absolutely devastated by the passing of Ben, and the impacts of his death will be felt by all in our community.
Ferntree Gully President Lee Thompson also offering this message on behalf of Ben's grieving parents.
As a mark of respect, both Jason and Tracy have asked that everyone out there that loves the game of cricket puts their bats out for Benny at their front door and their cricket gear or anything that makes them think of cricket and honours Ben.
Mike Baird is the chair of Cricket Australia.
We are doing everything we can to support the family, the club and all those impacted by this tragic news. Clearly, there are things that we have to learn from this.
Ben Austin's cause of death is yet to be determined, but it brings back memories for many of the death of former Test star Philip Hughes a decade ago, killed in similar circumstances. Former Australian fast bowler Merv Hughes spoke on Nova Radio.
Very similar to what Phil Hughes went through. So hit in the side of the neck on an artery there, and it just crushes the artery. So it just shows that, mate, even if you're wearing helmets and whatever, it's still a very dangerous game. And like Aussie rules football, like any code of football, really, it's a contact sport. There's going to be injuries.
The family of Philip Hughes also paying tribute in a statement. We send our warmest sympathies as you navigate through this time, as we know all too well. According to Cricket Victoria, Ben had been wearing a helmet but not a neck protector. And while helmets do not prevent concussions, they do protect against skull fractures and other head injuries. Professor Alan Pearce is a neurophysiologist at Swinburne University who specialises in sports-related concussion and repetitive brain trauma.
At the moment, cricket helmets are mandated at all levels of the game. But only since 2023 has what we call stem guards or neck protectors that come off the helmet are mandated for Cricket Australia contracted players, so national, international players.
Professor Pearce says it's difficult to analyse the prevalence of neck injuries because both head and neck injuries are classified in the same broad category, but believes neck protectors are a necessary step in avoiding serious injury.
All it really needs to do is protect the arteries that run up the side of the neck, because if the ball is travelling, you know, at 100 kilometres an hour, we know how hard the cricket ball is. What it does is that it can actually sever the artery, and that's where catastrophic injury occurs.
Professor Pearce is now pushing for stem guards to be made mandatory at all levels of the game, not just reserving them for the experts.
It's not mandated at the International Cricket Council. What you see from the research is that, you know, anywhere between sort of 6 to 17% of injuries to the head neck region actually occurred without the ball hitting the helmet at all. So we need to be thinking a little bit more broadly than just the ball hitting the front of the head, because the ball can hit the side or the back or the neck, which actually happens more often than we realise.
Neurophysiologist Alan Pearce ending that report by Kathleen O'Connor. This is PM. I'm Stephanie Smail. It's been revealed sunscreens banned from the United States over issues with their base formulation were sold in Australia for years after that ban. The sunscreen manufacturer at the centre of multiple recent sunscreen recalls was blocked from exporting to the United States in 2022. Echo Hawaii reports.
Even on a rainy day, Angie Neggs has to make sure she's completely protected from the sun.
My lupus particularly is highly stimulated by UV exposure.
The Brisbane women regularly used 2 of 19 sunscreens that have been recalled or paused from sale in recent weeks over concerns they weren't meeting their SPF claims.
First I was angry and now I'm just disappointed.
They were all made using the same base formulation from Perth manufacturer Wildchild Laboratories.
And at that point I went, you know what, I don't feel like the full story's being told.
An ABC investigation has found Wildchild has been blocked from importing their sunscreens to the US since 2022 due to violations of its good manufacturing practice. But Australia's regulator, the TGA, continued to allow Wildchild to supply sunscreens. Vice President of the Australian Medical Association, Julian Raitt.
I think that in this situation, there are obviously some things to learn from the fact that the signal might have been missed earlier on.
A 2024 audit report from America's regulator, obtained by the ABC, reveals the agency uncovered several violations in Wildchild's manufacturing processes. U.S. consumer product testing expert Dr. Michael Trout says those findings raise concerns.
The violations from the 2024 report essentially covered nearly every aspect of manufacture of the product.
The audit report identified issues with Wildchild's testing procedures, along with how they dealt with product faults and with their quality control procedures.
There was a notable lack of quality assurance within all the processes of manufacturing, testing, and release of the product.
In a statement, Wildchild CEO Tom Kernel said all issues identified by the FDA have been addressed by significant investment in its facility. But the FDA's import restrictions remain in place. The TGA says it conducted its own GMP inspection of the facility last month, but said it did not identify any manufacturing issues that could have contributed to the low SPF results. Dr. Trout has called on the TGA to release its audit report.
It would be far more reassuring, I think, to everyone if they could make those audit observations public so that we can see, has the company actually changed its ways?
The TGA did not answer the ABC's questions as to whether it would make its audit report public. Meanwhile, NGNX has lost faith in Australia's medical regulator.
The TGA has lost their social license right now in terms of telling us what is safe and how to protect ourselves and our families from the sun.
The TGA's investigation is ongoing. In the meantime, Julian Raitt says Australians should still use sunscreen.
That report by Echo Hoy, Nina Copel and Rachel Carbonell. Support groups say Australia's homelessness is costing the nation's economy billions of dollars. There are calls for a full inquiry into the crisis. Julia Bergen prepared this report.
The day Vicky Vicondia secured government housing, her life started to change.
That's when I had stability. I knew that I wasn't going to get kicked out. Nobody was going to sell the home. You know, I wasn't going to become homeless again. It was affordable. And that's when I was able to go out and study, further my studies, and then get back into the professional world and work.
For 4.5 years, Vicky Vicondias lived in crisis accommodation with her children after fleeing domestic violence. They were constantly on the move, disrupting her kids' education and making it impossible for her to find and keep a job.
My number one priority was to protect my children, but also try and accommodate us. I tried to find housing. The bar was set too high because of the high rental market and, you know, having to live day by day. That was, for me, enough to block me from actually applying for jobs.
Vicky Vakondias now works in the community services sector as a teacher, and every day she hears stories like her own.
It takes a lot away, and there's a lot of waste, and it impacts children. It impacts them, you know, mentally. It impacts them with their confidence as well. They're not being brought up to think about, you know, all the positive and all the different type of things that they can do and, you know, and be ambitious and all of that sort of stuff.
Today, Homelessness Australia is asking the Federal Government's Productivity Commission to launch a full inquiry into Australia's housing crisis. CEO Kate Colvin says homelessness is costing the country billions in lost productivity.
The link between homelessness and productivity was really the missing piece in the government's productivity agenda. The reality is if you don't have somewhere to sleep at night, you're not going to be able to turn up to work the next day ready to give your best effort. And in fact, actually, people often just have to quit work altogether because the business of being homeless and trying to find somewhere to live just takes all of your time.
For over a decade, the Productivity Commission has conducted annual reviews into housing and homelessness. But Kate Colvin wants a much more targeted probe. She says research shows every dollar invested in youth homelessness prevention generates $2.60 for the economy, all due to increased productivity.
Homelessness does have these impacts across the system, but it doesn't then translate into the investment that's needed in homelessness. So we'd need more attention on homelessness as being at the core of lots of other issues like mental health and poor physical health.
Matthew Bowes is with the Grattan Institute's Housing and Economic Security Program. He argues a clear link exists between housing and productivity.
The broader question of how housing impacts society and the productivity of our nation, I think, is a really important one. And clearly the fact that people can't find affordable housing in well-located areas, and that's particularly important for low-income people who are then locked out of the job markets in those areas. That is something that's really important to productivity. So there's definitely that link, but I think we should be clear that when we're talking about homelessness, the reason to solve homelessness is because it's frankly a moral failing on our society.
The Productivity Commissioner, Dr. Angela Jackson, says it's important to understand the broad impacts of homelessness on productivity and welcomes the opportunity to undertake an inquiry.
Julia Bergen reporting. Street signs are often a sought-after souvenir to hang on a wall, and a sign saying Slag Street is proving too tempting for visitors to Broken Hill. But residents in the outback city say enough is enough, saying they've lost count of the number of times the sign has been nicked. Kokahala Connor reports.
Sid Siddle has lived on Slag Street for 50 years, the Broken Hill Street named after the giant slag heap in the centre of town.
I think it's a good name because they're all named after, as you know, streets of Broken Hill named after minerals. Well, slag is the dross off the mines, the slag heaps. I think it's unique.
Do you feel like, I know we've obviously got the slag heap in the middle of the town, we've got a gallery called Slag Heap Projects. Is there like a sense of pride around the slag kind of word?
Yes, I feel quite proud of the name and it's often a talking point.
Looking at a map of Broken Hill is like looking up the periodic table. Among others, there's Chloride Street and Bromide Street and Oxide Street. But the Slag Street sign in particular has become quite the collector's item. And this local resident has lost count of the number of times the street sign has been stolen over the years.
As soon as the council replace it, it gets stolen. And I don't know whether they like the name just want to take the sign for themselves.
I agree with Sid. There needs to be some way of securing those signs so they can't be taken every couple of months.
Broken Hill Mayor Tom Kennedy is at his wit's end. Now the local council is considering making a Slag Street sign available for sale at the visitors' centre.
Council actually has those signs, so people, rather than steal them, perhaps you could go in there to the... I know it's probably more fun stealing signs, but costs a lot of money to replace signs. It's not just the sign itself, it's the work to take to replace it.
Sid Siddle, meanwhile, is keeping a sharp eye out for when thieves strike. He's slowed down a bit of late. He suffers from Parkinson's and drop foot. When a couple of sign stealers struck recently, there wasn't much he could do other than watch on in frustration.
They came up to the signpost with a four-wheel drive and stood on the roof bar or the bumper bar at the front with it adjacent to the sign. I did the nuts, took the sign and off they went.
Sid is worried visitors won't be able to find the street.
You can see why I get frustrated over the... Mm. This is a matter of years this has been going on. Mm. So you can see why I get a little bit irate.
Sid Siddle of Slag Street, ending that report from Kokahala Connor in Broken Hill. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Stephanie Smale. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Kamala Harris is back on your screens. Yes, she's spruiking a memoir, but she's also testing the waters to see if she could run again for the US presidency. Today, 7:30 host Sarah Ferguson on her Australian exclusive interview with the former vice president. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.